Session number 13305, reel number 3.
That's the Redaway reel 3.
Yes, we were stationed in Bielefeld in the spring of 1945, and when the signal came through to move up the road to Berlin, we had an amusing incident as we drew level with Hanover on the Autobahn. It was a delegation of worthies from Hanover who said that they thought it was a mistake that because of Queen Victoria's sex, they'd been separated from the British Empire in 1837, and they felt it would be timely to rejoin Britain, and would we please accept this piece of paper stating this view?
This was for some political union?
I think it was, yes. I think they felt that Niedersachsen was in low water, and that Hanover needed a new deal, and that a reversion to its traditional links with Hanoverian Britain would be a good idea. And so we duly took note of this and passed on up the road to Berlin. And there we found that the Russians were very much in control of Berlin. It was divided into 20 regions or municipalities, the Verwaltungsbezirke, and we had six, and the Americans had six, and the Russians had eight. Later the French had two of ours. But it divided three ways like that. And our little teams moved into the different Verwaltungsbezirke and became the supreme authority municipally in those Verwaltungsbezirke. And the three-power headquarters, shortly to be four-power when the French arrived, was set up in the American sector in a nice building in Dahlem, and we set about drawing up procedures, and ours had a remarkable resemblance to what one had been taught at Camberley in the way of drawing up procedures, and we settled down to decide how Berlin should be governed, and when we'd agreed on what needed to be said, we then served papers on the Oberbürgermeister, who was a chap called Olschowski, no, Ostrovsky, I can't remember, one of those two, and Olschowski, I can't remember, and he, poor chap, got his chits from the from the military government, the four-power military government, and was supposed to act on them. But in fact, it became pretty clear fairly soon. We had a great honeymoon period when the Russians simply said, oh, we'll go anyway, you know, we're all friends and so forth. But then it became fairly clear that the Russians meant to run their bit of Berlin on strictly communist lines, and their zone on strictly communist lines. There was no nonsense about leaving it to the Germans to sort themselves out, and that they would like to see the whole of Berlin as part of the Russian zone. Indeed, it was very anomalous that you should have Berlin as an island in this Russian sea of territory about 100 miles from the border with our zone in West Germany. And of course it became fairly clear that the Russians could put a squeeze on us if they wanted to at any time, and so gradually the relationship rather ossified, and Berlin became a microcosm of all the East-West problems that became dominant in foreign policy. And so you had the Kommandantura with your delegations of Russian, French, American, and British officers Russians under very strict political guidance, facing the problems of socialist unity parties and such like, which the Russians were promoting hard, and they were trying to sell the idea that the German socialists and the German communists would form up as one party, which would be a very suitable governing party for Berlin. And of course the same sort of thing to apply to the zone, and who knew, the whole of Germany with any luck. So you had a lot of extremely interesting political problems to cope with, which we didn't have much in the way of training or guidance. But we were lucky to have an extremely shrewd cavalry brigadier in Hind, who was liked very much by the Russians and the other allies, not letting himself be bamboozled by Russian rhetoric.
Were the Russians at first adopting a revengeful attitude towards the Germans in Berlin?
Yes, I think they were. But they'd got most of the really sweeping extractions over before we arrived. That's why they had this 3 months or so in which they were cleaning up the place to their liking and putting in prison or abducting people they didn't like and setting up stooges who they reckoned would turn into good communists who would do what they wanted. And so there wasn't all that sign of vengefulness, because most of that had gone over. But whereas we, the Allies, settled down to ensuring that life would go on in Germany, and that this would mean so many sacks of coal and so many sacks of wheat, the Russians were pretty cavalier. I remember when one of the committees on Fuhrer and Power had met, our earnest representatives said, well, we've got to have so much coal and so much oil and so forth, and this will involve this and that movement, and here was a paper showing how it could be done. The Russians produced a bit of paper starting off, Berliners, you will be warm this winter. Making it fairly clear that if they were going to be warm this winter, they'd better do something about it themselves. That was rather the way it was. They hadn't really prepared for what we would call a civil affairs effort. They didn't really mind too much what happened to the Germans.
Was there any element of arrogance in the attitude of the Western powers towards the Germans?
Yes, I think there would be. I mean, we'd been struggling against them since 39, and the war was entirely Hitler's, etc.'s notion. And I think that there was a feeling that they got what was coming to them. And there weren't so many good Germans, but fairly quickly we got down to the business of ensuring that they would get so many calories, I think it was 1,200, which would be enough to keep them alive, whereas the Russians weren't going to count calories. They were going to rely on native enterprise and what came in from the farms in the country. So I think by and large, we started pretty resentful and became much more sympathetic when we saw that they really were in a terrible mess and there were a great many innocent people suffering.
What policy were you adopting towards the National Socialist Party members? And
oh, there was a great rigmarole called the denazification program, which was tremendously well worked out, and endless bump, and there was a thing called the Fragebogen, the questionnaire, which you had to fill up if you were going to have any sort of office. And I think the Russians were a good deal more cavalier again, like this. They would put in anyone, whether ex-Nazi or not, who was likely to go their way, and we had a much more elaborate and cumbersome and probably ineffective way of screening who were Nazis and who weren't.
We sometimes hear allegations about the role of the Americans and their intelligence agencies in getting people out of Germany for their own purposes after the war. Did you come across any of that?
Yes, I think the Americans were much more realistic than we were. They spotted people like von Braun and other people who would be useful to them as leading scientists and technicians, and if they were in the American zones or wanted to go, I think they would facilitate them, and they did them a lot of good, of course, by taking their technology with them. The Russians similarly took all sorts of people who they reckoned would be useful. We evolved a great bureaucratic exercise, I think it was called Operation Mousetrap, which had so much red tape in it that I think we fared very poorly on this. Of course, we had had the pick German brains in the brain drain before the war. We had a tremendous number of extremely talented Jews and the odd anti-Nazi who'd come over and did great work for us. But by and large, I think the Russians and the Americans were far more realistic about using German talents than we were. And of course, you got the odd thing happening, like a bunch of British industrialists going over and looking at the Wolfsburg VW factory and concluding that this really had no commercial potential at all. They could have had it for nothing, virtually. Well, this sort of amateurism, I'm afraid, didn't speak very highly for us. But by and large, I think we were the most popular in German eyes of the occupying powers, because we were basically reasonably sympathetic. And of course, we were closer to them than the Americans geographically.
How did your period come to an end in Germany?
My period in Germany ended when the British month ended in May. We took it in turns in the Kommendatura. We had a Russian month, an American month, a British month, and a French month. And our month ended in May of 46, by which time I'd taken the Foreign Office exam in Hanover. And or been considered eligible for it. I think I'd taken some preliminary test in Hanover. And it was the natural time for me to get out after nearly 7 years in the army. And so I got on the leave train in early June of 1946, came back to England, took the final bit of the Foreign Office exam and was accepted. And my army leave ran out the day before I joined the Foreign Office in the 2nd of October of 1946, so I'd had 7 years inside.
You were telling me earlier off the record that you were personally involved in the Suez Crisis. Can you tell me in what capacity that was?
Yes, this was quite an interesting little story. I started in the German department, quite logically, in October of 1946. And then in probably December of 1946, Lord Pakenham was put in to be the minister, spending half his time in the Foreign Office and half his time in Norfolk House. We'd made a major blunder by saying, well, Germany is going to be so complicated, we will set up a special ministry under the member for Attercliffe, J.B. Hind, who would be the minister for Germany and take all the burdens and the tiresome questions of Germany away from the Foreign Office. And of course this was a disaster because Germany was the central point really for all the East-West relationships which were developing and going to dominate foreign policy. And so the Foreign Office decided to get out of this by appointing Lord Pakenham as a minister with a foot in both places, with the clear intention that the major question should revert to the Foreign Office. And so it turned out. Norfolk House became the administrative headquarters for administering the Control Commission, which was quite large, of course, at that time. And major foreign policy decisions on Germany reverted to the Foreign Office. So Lord Pakenham spent more and more of his time in the Foreign Office. And I enjoyed very much being his private secretary. He was an extremely nice man, though the Foreign Office tended to regard him as too soft by half. All this muttering about the Germans needing more calories and so on was regarded with some suspicion by the fairly hardliners in the Foreign Office. And I think my greatest impact on foreign policy was when I was playing squash with him in early 47, and I dropped a short one, and he made a great jump towards it, and his Achilles tendon parted. And he spent about 6 weeks in hospital, during which time, of course, the Foreign Office mandarins got at all the questions that on which they differed from him. And this made, I think, a considerable difference in our attitude to Germany. But by and large, Bevin, who was a very fair-minded foreign minister, wasn't going to let the Germans starve. And Pakenham, I think, did a very good job as being a humanitarian conscience for a time, but then he gradually became less important. And in fact, I went to join Christopher Mayhew, who had been in the army with me, as he became a junior minister in the Foreign Office, doing the parliamentary business. And so I shifted over to him, doing the parliamentary questions for him and for Ernest Bevin and Hector McNeill, the other minister. Well, this leads up to what happened in the Suez, in that we went off to the United Nations in September of 47 and found that Bevin and Mayhew and McNeill were being belaboured by the Russians, who obviously had a very large research and opinion influencing organisation at their disposal, and they really beat us round the head. And Mayhew had the idea that we really must do something to counter this, and Bevin agreed that it must be went into, and so it was went into by Chris Mayhew, who had the great advantage of having been at the same school and a cricket enthusiast that Clem Attlee had been at Haileybury. And he wrote a paper on the way back from the UN on the Queen Mary, the end of 47, which resulted in a thing called the Information Research Department being set up, which was a research unit which would supply ministers in the first place with really well-researched material about things like Soviet imperialism, the gulags, which nobody had mentioned before, and so that we could actually have some counter-say to what the Russians were doing to us. And this grew into quite an important department in the Foreign Office with a large number of researchers. I left to go to Rome in November of 49 and then to Canada, came back in 55 and was put in to this information research department, which got rather bogged down, and see if I could liven it up. Well, I wasn't very enthusiastic about this because it was outside the normal run of Foreign Office work. I found when I got there, I thoroughly enjoyed it. And because you could do so much in it. And nobody in the Mandarinate really bothered too much about it. The ministers used it spasmodically, and it turned rather into what most research units are, namely a bump distributing body. But it had some very good ideas and some very good contacts with publicists. And when Suez blew up, which here we are in 1956, it was called on really to do something about NASA. And of course, you can't just switch on an effort against NASA, who's regarded by as a hero in the Arab world. And really, the efforts around Suez were pretty poor. And the head of the department gave himself full time on Middle East and Suez, and I was given the rest of the department. And I must say it was great relief to concentrate on Hungary, which was going at that time, which we really could help over. And the Suez business, from our point of view, publicity and propaganda, was pretty well a dead loss, because you couldn't support really convincingly vis-a-vis public and international opinion a very dubious line that Anthony Eden was taking. But I think we learnt quite a lot about publicity, and General Keithley and Mountbatten drew up a report after it suggesting that we should be much more high-powered in our information and publicity effort, and that there should be someone in the cabinet responsible for it. Well, something happened. We did get a cabinet minister as a result of that Suez fiasco. But unless you have someone like, say, Ted Heath wanting to get into Europe, you don't get much backing for what you might call operational research. Although we had a glorious time in the early 70s when Ted Heath was determined to do everything he could to get into Europe and influence public opinion, after 74 it gradually went downhill and was dissolved in 77 by the Labour government.
What could the IRD do in relation to Hungary in 1956?
Well, there's just two examples. I mean, this isn't really relevant, but for about 3 weeks, the only information about what was happening in Hungary came out over the British diplomatic wireless in code into the outside world. In other words, the Americans had always relied on line. And so we were the possessors of a really authentic ringside commentary from our mission in Budapest on what was going on in Hungary. Well, these days there is mighty little sophisticated exploitation of that sort of intelligence. But in fact, what happened to that was that we teamed up with Reuters in the Strand and said, look, do you want these things? Because they're exclusive to you if you do. We'll give them to someone else if you don't. And of course they said, yes, they'd love it. And I said, well, they'll have to be datelined anyway, except Budapest. Oh, they said, no problem about that. But it's all authentic. You can't quote the source, but we can vouch for them. And so for about 3 weeks, Reuters, which of course spreads the message all over the world through the plumbing, if you like, of the news machine, was virtually the sole authentic source of information about Hungary. Well, that was one thing that was laid on through the researchers in the Information Research Department. One other example, there was a chap called Shand, Mick Shand, who is an Australian, I think British-educated Australian high-powered diplomat, who was put in charge of the UN report on Hungary. In other words, the UN wanted something authentic about Hungary. And he came over. He'd been a friend of my brother's at Cambridge. And he got in touch with me and said, look, we don't know anything about Hungary. Have you anyone who does? Oh, yes, I said, you know, we've got a very good research section on Hungary. Well, he said, would you mind sketching me up some notes for the UN special report on Hungary? He said, no, delighted. And very quickly, we produced an extremely good piece of paper, ream of paper, which looked very much like a draft report by the International Committee on Hungary. I think there was a South American who knew nothing about it, and I think someone from the Far East who knew nothing about it, and McShand. And so you got for the UN, as their document, something which came from Britain. And again, it was all serious stuff. There was no propaganda in it. And it was the news, and this, as I was saying, is the strength of the BBC Overseas Service. It was straight news, but seen through British eyes. And this is the sort of way in which you can really influence opinion in a legitimate way by doing the staff work and having the contacts and having the research facility. And of course, this was considered a considerable success. And it was that sort of marrying up the people with the information and no voice with the media, which have the voice and no information, to the benefit of both. And it was by this sort of means we got rid of Sukarno probably 2 or 3 years earlier than he'd have gone anyway, in 1965-66, by getting extremely good information about what was going on in Indonesia, and getting it into the right hands. And of course, this was the thing that we'd all forgotten about by the time the Falklands crisis came up in early 82, where we had streams of intelligence coming back from our missions and our military people in South America, and this was all digested and passed around in Whitehall. It never occurred to anyone then that it wouldn't be a bad idea to get a series of authentic and well-written pieces of paper and give them exclusive, say, to the UP man in Montevideo or the AP man in New York, or even following the Hungarian precedent to Reuters in the Strand. And who knows, the product that we had of intelligence streaming in February and March of 82 might have rendered unnecessary the few billions of expenditure which we were let in for in April of 82. But it's a good example of how the lessons are not learnt and how the techniques, if they don't appeal to officers and gentlemen, are ignored. And as I mentioned, John Knott and Frank Cooper were entirely oblivious of what had happened either at Suez or over Hungary or over Sukarno. They just started with a vacant mind and made every sort of mistake that you could wish for.